Moto Casino, American Social Casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, American Social Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisiscle.com/podcast.
Lock your doors, close the blinds, change your passwords. This is the Dry Cleaner Cast. Welcome to the Dry Cleaner Cast, a podcast that takes a new look at the war on terror, its legacy, and espionage in the 21st century. This podcast is written, edited, and presented by Chris Carr.
On this month's podcast, I am joined by author and journalist Amy Knight, and we discuss the Russian intelligence services and political murder. Amy is the author of a number of fantastic books, such as How the Cold War Began and Orders to Kill, which is the basis of our conversation today. As you listen to this podcast, if you click on the image in your podcast app, you'll find a link to Orders to Kill. Also, there'll be more information on our website about Amy and her past works if you go to www.drycleanercast.co.uk. You'll find a page dedicated to this episode with show notes and links to her past work. If you like what we're doing, please become a Patreon subscriber. Your subscription helps me keep this podcast going by contributing to running costs such as website and podcast hosting fees. This podcast costs about £40 a month to run, so any donations, any subscriptions go towards those running costs. And hopefully you've noticed I've upgraded some of our microphones. I now use a lovely Shure SM58 for my side of the conversation. And I'm hoping that it's slightly improved things. I'm also using new audio software for mixing the episodes. And that is all thanks to the Patreon subscribers, which are Shane Whaley, Jeff Quest, and Thomas Lumo, who are our current subscribers. And hello to Christina Hartland and Jens Nordberg, who are following the podcast on Patreon. I also want to say a thank you to some of our regular listeners. Nelson Inacio, I hope I pronounced that correctly. Alex Johan Gerdesen. Chris Kurjevan, Manny Gruel, Cam Dio, James Robert Brown, Nella Fabisi. I also want to say hello to Mark 2 Salamander, who follows us on Twitter. I also want to say hello to Penny Wint, who has been a long-time listener and a long-time supporter. Penny, I hope you're well. I also want to say hello to Miss Cherry Jones. And a special hello to John Cypher, former CIA officer. Hopefully I can get you on the show in the future, but we'll have to chat about that. But thank you for following the podcast on Twitter. So now time for a quick disclaimer, and then we will get going.
Opinions expressed by guests on this podcast do not necessarily represent those of the filmmakers and sponsors of the film, The Dry Cleaner.
Amy, welcome to the Dry Cleaner Cast.
Thank you.
Just for the listeners who are not familiar with your work, please can you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
I began being interested in Russian studies when I was an undergraduate student at the University of Michigan, and I majored in Russian studies, yeah. Which had become a new field that opened up area studies. And I learned, as part of my program, I learned Russian. And I traveled to what was then the Soviet Union in 1967 with a group of students and professors. And I did not heed the warnings of our professors and the people who were escorting us that we should be very, very careful about mingling with Russians. This was at the time when the Cold War was really at its height. And, of course, we students didn't listen and got involved with some independent-minded, perhaps dissidents in Kiev. And I ended up getting arrested along with another with a group of students. And I was held for a whole night in the local KGB office jail in Kiev. And I was so interested. They ended up asking me all sorts of things about, you know, what kind of a car my father had. And they struck me as people who were not just policemen, but also I was just interested in the whole human aspect of these men. And so afterwards, it didn't come to fruition for a number of years, but I kind of made a study of the KGB my little niche. And after I got my PhD and I was working at the U.S. Library of Congress as a Soviet affairs analyst, I delved further into the KGB, and that's when I wrote my first book called The KGB, Police and Politics in the Soviet Union.
Wow. What was it? So that must have been, I mean, God, that must have been really quite frightening, being arrested by the KGB.
You know, it's funny, and maybe I'm glossing over it now, but I was actually, I knew they weren't going to do anything to me because I hadn't done anything wrong. And so I had a feeling that they weren't going to keep me. But, of course, they had arrested another student the summer before last. Mm. So that possibility was in my mind, but I kept just thinking this is such an experience that I really actually, you know, at 21, you don't worry about things like you do when you get older.
Yeah. Yeah, so you weren't worried you're going to end up on Glenorchy Bridge being swapped for a spy?
No, I was not that important, trust me.
Well, look, today we're going to discuss Russian intelligence and their apparent use of political murder as a tool to silence critics of the Kremlin, both historically and contemporarily. Before we look at the current events, I'd like to just sort of look into the past. And before we even go into the past, what is political murder?
Well, in my book, I quote Franklin Ford, who was a Harvard historian. And I think his definition is a really good one. He calls it homicide related to the body politic and its governance. And so that pretty much would include narrowly targeted assassinations and maybe even random killings, all intended to intimidate political opponents. So these are killings that have a political purpose. But I also include in my book, I make it a broader term because I include political murder to encompass state-sponsored terrorism for political purposes.
Yeah. Russia's not the only country that's used sort of political murder as a tool, and though sadly it is a reality and part of the country's history, can you talk to us a bit about the relationship between politics and murder in Russia's history?
There's a very good quote from the French historian Hélène Carrière-Duncas, and she notes that Russia, 11 centuries of a history notable for its murders make Russia unlike any other country. Yes, historians have drawn attention to the fact that Russia has particularly violent history.
Yeah.
When it comes to murders for political purposes. I don't think that Russians are by any means more bloodthirsty than other nationalities, but I think there are several factors that this can be attributed to. They were occupied by the Mongols, who were very savage and vicious for 2.5 centuries, and Russia had a large, vast territory that was very difficult to defend. And I think that this resulted in more political violence than perhaps in other European countries. And then there was this whole problem of succession with the czars. And the czars tended to often use political murder as a way of solving succession and political scores. I mentioned that even Peter the Great, who we all know for being a forward-looking, westernizing monarch, who was very enlightened, his regime was known to be stained with blood. Political opposition was a continual feature of Peter's reign, and he used torture and execution to quell unrest and revolts. And even his son and heir, Alexei, died under mysterious circumstances in 1718. He was imprisoned in Peter and Paul Fortress. He had been charged with treason. And there are quite a few historians who think that Peter was responsible for his death, Peter the Great. And then Catherine the Great, her husband, Peter the Third, had only been czar for about 6 months before he was murdered in 1762. And supposedly he died of a hemorrhoidal colic aggravated by a stroke. But there were a lot of rumors that, in fact, Catherine, his wife, had orchestrated a murder. So we don't know for sure. And then Catherine the Great, who died in 1796, her son Paul became czar, but he actually was murdered in his bedchamber by a group of noblemen who were concerned about his inconsistent and erratic ruling policies, and particularly those that related to international questions. His son, Alexander the First, actually fell under suspicion for involvement in his murder, but we don't know for sure. So it wasn't until the mid 19th century that Russia became more like European countries and did not use succession as a means of solving executions or murders as a means of solving political issues.
Yeah, I mean, gosh, it sounds, when you describe it, it sounds a bit like Game of Thrones a little bit, doesn't it? It's just,
yes,
it's quite,
yes,
a history.
Exactly. Yes.
And also in sort of more recent times, the Bolshevik Revolution is quite an interesting period, because that's when they had the creation of the Cheka, which was the Russian secret police that preceded the KGB, if I'm correct. I think I am. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and right. Yeah, and that led to you know, sort of everything from it, quite a sort of series of political murders even in that time. Is that right?
Well, yes. These were not really secret murders by the Cheka as much as basically a reign of terror to suppress opposition to the Bolshevik regime. The Bolsheviks quickly found themselves sort of surrounded by enemies, and the principal way that they were able to initially ensure their rule, which was to commit acts of violence, including execution, against their enemies.
Yeah, and one of the things that cropped up in your early part of your book was about the creation of these sort of poison labs in the 1920s, and the sort of the use of poison in a lot of cases historically against sort of political enemies. You've already mentioned a few, but is just so interesting that this poison lab was sort of created so early in the kind of the beginning of sort of communist Russia.
Yes, and interestingly enough, poison has been an enduring feature of the Russian police and secret security agencies. You're right. They use poison. It's believed, and again, we're talking about speculation with fairly good grounds. I'd give you one example: would be the death of Maxim Gorky in June of 1936. He was one of Russia's best-known writers, as you probably know, and he had been on very good terms with Stalin, But Stalin began to have doubts about the writings of Gorky, and it's believed that Stalin began to view him as an enemy, and so he supposedly died of illness. But there's been a lot of speculation that the NKVD actually poisoned him. So that would have been the NKVD was a successor to the Cheka, and it was a secret police that was very powerful. At the time, it was run by Genrikh Yagoda. And so that's just one example of their use of poison.
Yeah. And sorry, it was a case, I'm sorry, I've forgotten the name, where radioactive material was actually used against a former traitor, and it was very similar to what happened to Alexander Litvinenko. Can you remember who that was?
It was Nikolai Hoklov.
That's it,
He was a KGB officer who defected, actually, to the United States in 1954.
Yeah.
And he testified before the U.S. House Un-American Affairs Committee about the operations of the KGB. And undoubtedly, this raised the ire of KGB officials in Russia. And when he was visiting Frankfurt, Germany, in 1957 for a speaking engagement, Hochloff was poisoned by radioactive thallium. And this was the same material poison that at first was suspected in the Litvinenko murder, although later it was shown that Litvinenko was poisoned by polonium. But Hochloff lived, but it was, you know, a very scary episode for him. And then, of course, there was another example of poison being used, and this was in London, in the killing of Georgi Markov, who was a Bulgarian dissident working for the BBC. And it was a very famous institute when he was walking across Waterloo Bridge in 1978. And some unknown person came up and stabbed him with an umbrella. And he, of course, died. It's now well established, thanks to KGB defector Oleg Kalugin, that in fact the KGB supplied the poison ricin that was injected into Markov.
Yeah, and it was in a little pellet, wasn't it? That it kind of leaked out the ricin over time. You can actually see the a mock up of the umbrella at the International Spy Museum in Washington.
Yes. And this is something that basically we know for sure that this happened.
Yes. Well, let's have a look at Russian intelligence today. It's quite a complex picture, actually, Kraika. So, America, Russia has multiple intelligence agencies, and I'd like to just sort of do our best to kind of navigate as many of those agencies as we can. And before we dive into that, there were two terms that popped up in your book, and forgive my pronunciation, it's probably going to be terrible. Is it Siloviki and Pitersky? So, I don't know if I've got that right.
Siloviki and Pitersky.
Thank you.
And Siloviki has been used so commonly now that it's almost taken as a given, but people, you're right, there's a good question. It comes from the Russian word for strength, and it basically means the power agencies. These are the people that actually have weapons and can enforce their power. This would include the police and the security agencies, and also the military. But the military really doesn't figure in too much into the politics. The military, Soviet and Russian military, have pretty much stayed away from politics. But of course, you know, the Minister of Defense is a Silovik, a man of power. But when we talk about the clan that surrounds Putin, the group of Siloviki, we're talking mainly about the police and the security, heads of the police and security agencies. And then another term that's often used are the Pitersky. And this is a reference to Putin's allies Putin comes from, he was born in then Leningrad, which has now been renamed St. Petersburg. And Putin has had a tendency to surround himself with his allies from St. Petersburg. And so this is why particularly the St. Petersburg KGB, FSB, and so this is why the term, this is where the term Petersky comes up. It refers to the group of men that were Putin's friends and allies when he was working and living in St. Petersburg.
Yeah, and then, as you were saying, these men sort of pop up a lot when we start to look at sort of contemporary Russian intelligence. They're all pretty much either in position as heads of these agencies or were former heads of these agencies. Just through looking at your book, you suddenly sort of see a pattern. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I think Russia today is very clan-oriented and sort of like the mafia. They're also corrupt, but yes, there tends to be a formation of clans, and the Petersburg Petersky clan is, of course, the most powerful because that's a clan that's supported by President Putin.
Yeah, let's have a look at these agencies as you know as best as we can. So, can you tell us about the FSB?
Well, the FSB. It stands for Federalnaya Služba Bezopasnosti, or Federal Security Service. And it was it's basically the most powerful Russian security agency. It was established in 1995 after we saw various reorganizations of the KGB, which was disbanded, as you know, in 1991 after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And we saw the statue of Felix Dzerzhinsky, who founded the Cheka, being brought down forcibly by a group of opposition Democrats. So after some reorganizations, we saw the formation of the FSB. And, you know, the numbers of employees are basically estimates, but it's estimated, we don't know for sure, but about 350,000 employees are working at the FSB. And its functions are roughly similar to those of the second directorate of the KGB, which was the directorate or service for counterintelligence. Pretty similar to your MI5 or the American FBI. But the FSB, of course, is more powerful, I think, than either the American or the British counterpart. Its functions include counterintelligence, counterterrorism, which has become a huge, very important mandate for the FSB. They also are responsible for combating economic crimes, guarding the borders, protecting government communications, which would be a separate function in the UK and in America. They're also responsible significantly for the security of nuclear materials and installations. So this is a very, very important agency. And I'll just quote a Russian expert on the security services, Andrei Soldatov, who says, quote, rather than a revival of the Soviet KGB, the FSB has evolved into something more powerful and more frightening. An agency whose scope under the aegis of a veteran KGB officer extended well beyond the bounds of its predecessor. And of course, the veteran KGB officer he's referring to is Vladimir Putin.
Yes. And the FSB also run a mass surveillance system, is it? And it's called SORM. Is there anything you could just sort of tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, and this, of course, is something more modern than under the KGB, where the internet wasn't a threat. But for Russia and for the Kremlin, the internet is a very, very formidable threat. And so they have a system called SORM, standing for S-O-R-M, the acronym. And it monitors emails, internet usage, Skype, cell phones, text messages, and social networks. It is a very, very powerful system. And in fact, interestingly enough, in 2014, the Russian parliament, the Duma, actually passed a law requiring social media websites to keep their servers in Russia and to hold data on users for 6 months. So this gives the SORM system that is overseen by the FSB particular powers. So this doesn't mean that internet users don't have freedom to use the internet. It's not like China, but there is extensive surveillance. Although I have to say that it's a challenge for the FSB.
Yes, I suppose there's so much information they go through.
Yes, and the main challenge is that because of their economy and financial dealings, Russia can't afford to curtail the internet to a huge extent because this would really threaten their economy. So they have to allow Google, for example, and all the other servers or systems that are basically Western and run by Americans. So it's a challenge between censorship, which they would like to increase, and the need for openness for its economy.
Yes. Yeah. And one last thing as well, it's worth bearing in mind with the FSB, you mentioned in your book that there's no external oversight of this agency beyond the office of the president.
Yes, this is true. In KGB days, the Politburo had oversight over the KGB. And the KGB was actually, they were directed by the Communist Party leadership. They weren't a freewheeling organization who could do what they wanted to do. We don't have that anymore. Russia doesn't have that anymore. There's no formal mechanism for oversight as there is in Western democracies. The parliament supposedly has oversight, the Duma. They have a committee on security, but it has basically no enforcement capabilities. So this means that it's Putin and his closest allies who control all the security agencies.
Yeah, and the current head, Alexandra Bortnikov, I'm practicing my Russian here, I hope it's right. He's part of the Peterursky, the kind of the Putin St. Petersburg kind of clan.
Yes, Bortnikov is another Petersky, as we would say, and he joined the KGB in 1975.
Yeah.
He's a longtime Putin loyalist, and he's obviously doing a very good job because Putin has kept him in that post for quite a while since he replaced Nikolai Patrushev, who was another close ally of Putin's and is now head of the National Security Council.
Yeah. So this is a very different picture of the FBI or MI5 in many respects, isn't it, about the way it's sort of controlled and managed?
Exactly.
Let's have a look at the MVD. This one's quite a key security agency. Can you just tell us a bit about them?
Well, the MVD, the Ministry of Internal Affairs, it numbers about 1,200,000 employees, and we call it the regular police in Russia. It's not the security police, but they're very important. The MVD is a very important agency. It conducts criminal investigations, as does the FSB, and it also played a very important role in the war in Chechnya because its internal troops, which number about 200,000, were key to suppressing separatism in Chechnya.
Yes.
The head of the MVD was a man named Rashid Nirgalyayev, who was also a St. Petersburg clan. He served as head of MVD until 2012, and then he was replaced with a man named Viktor Kolokoltsev, who is still remains head of the MVD.
Yeah. And Viktor Solotov, what was his connection to the MVD?
Well, he for a while was the first deputy head of the MVD before he became head of the National Guard, which was created in 2016. And he was tied to a St. Petersburg firm, which was basically, or a St. Petersburg gang, which was basically part of the Russian mafia, called the Tambov Game. And he was connected with a private security firm called Baltic Escort that acted as a liaison between the government and the Russian mafia. So Zolotov is very close to Putin, and he's also very close to the Russian St. Petersburg mafia.
Yeah.
And he supposedly drew up a hit list of opponents to Putin and his associates that the government was supposed to kill.
And it was quite an extensive list from what I remember.
Right.
Now, just before we move on to the next one, just to go back a little bit, the connection to the Russian mafia, it's a silly question, but why is that significant, that liaison between the government and the Russian mafia?
Well, the Russian mafia arose after the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. I mean, it had existed before to a certain extent. There were a lot of criminal groups even in the late 80s, but it became particularly strong because there was a sort of a vacuum of power in Russia. And there was a free-for-all for grabbing the resources of the Russian state. So the mafia kind of stepped in, and a lot of this struggle to gain control of important assets was carried out with violence. And because, you know, there wasn't really a solid system of law and order that as it existed before the Soviet collapse,
yes,
this opened up it opened up the field for Russians to form these mafia gangs that were that had access to that employed violent means to get a hold of, to grab, as I would say, the state resources. And there's quite a bit of documentation pointing to the fact that Putin himself, you know, he was working for the St. Petersburg mayor's office in the early 90s, and that Putin himself had ties to this mafia, in particular to the Tambov gang. And, the mafia continues actually to this day to have ties with the political leaders, although, you know, they're murky and we don't know exactly to what extent. But the oligarchs definitely had to use the mafia to gain their wealth and their power.
Yeah. And in some cases, the mafia appeared to provide a useful cutout for some of these deaths as well.
Yes, exactly. The mafia was used for to settle scores among different oligarchs, for example. Mm. And they could sort of step back from it. But yes, the mafia, together with the Chechens, has often been blamed for some of these murders that we've seen.
Yeah. Right. We're going to move on to another agency. There's one called the Procuracy that had an investigative function that was taken away from it because the agency was becoming too powerful for Putin's liking. Could you tell us a little bit about this agency?
The Procuracy, or the Prosecutor General's Office, was one of the chief agencies for criminal investigations, for high-level investigations. And they, after Putin assumed the presidency in 2000, the Procuracy became a very powerful investigative organ, but it started to, its officials started to have conflicts with other members of Putin's elite. And in 2007, the head of the procuracy is a man named Yuri Chaika. And he's a trusted Putin ally, but he wasn't a Peterski, or a member of the former member of the KGB. So in any case, in 2007, Putin decided to rein in the procuracy, and he created an independent investigative organ from the investigation body that had existed as part of the procuracy. That is called the Investigative Committee, and it's headed by Alexander Bastrykin. He has been the head of the Investigative Committee since 2007, and this is a very important agency because the Investigative Committee has played a key role in the investigation of the various political murders that I talk about in my book.
And another interesting issue that came up was the FSO, because it's sort of designed to protect the leadership from coups. And it's sort of seen as the eyes and ears for Putin on other agencies. Can you talk to us a little bit about the FSO?
Yeah, the FSO is the Federal Protection Service, or the Federal Service of Protection. And it emerged from, this agency emerged from what used to be the Ninth Directorate of the KGB, the Guards Directorate. So in historically, the Ninth Directorate was one of its responsibilities was ensuring the safety of government leaders and guarding government premises. So this was a crucial role, but it also, the Ninth Directorate was seen as the main body that would protect the leadership against any underlying threat. And also, the Ninth Directorate was responsible for the security of nuclear installations. So the Federal Protective Service has assumed many of these functions. And for a long time, it's been thought to be the sort of the eyes and ears for Putin. It's a smaller agency, but the heads of the Federal Protective Service have been known to just, you know, report directly to Vladimir Putin. So he views this as kind of his special, he has viewed it as his special guard, the ultimate protection for Mr. Putin. Until 2016, the FSO, or the Federal Protection Service, was headed by Yevgeny Murov, who is a Putin loyalist. Its current head is Dmitry Korchnev, and there's very little known about him, except that he had worked for a long time in the protective services. So he presumably is very loyal to Mr. Putin.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces. I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Like what we're doing? Connect with us on Twitter at DryCleanerCast. Support the show by becoming a DryCleanerCast Patreon subscriber today. Go to patreon.com/drycleanercast. That's patreon.com/drycleanercast.
Putin's kind of created a new agency in Russia, which is the Russian National Guard. And it sounded similar to a little bit to some of the functions of the FSO, being the eyes and ears of Putin. Can you talk to us a little bit about the National Guard?
Yes, that was created by President Putin in 2016. And significantly, he placed Viktor Zolotov, his buddy from St. Petersburg, He made Viktor Zolotov the head of this agency. And its basic function is preserving public order. So it's sort of the last bastion of protection for the Kremlin in the event that there would be civil unrest. This is something that the Kremlin, of course, is always very worried about. So the National Guard, again, very loyal to Putin. And it's an important force to prevent unrest from getting out of hand and threatening the Kremlin.
Yeah. And then there's the FSKN, which was a powerful drug enforcement agency formed in 2004 and then disbanded in 2016. What's significant about that agency?
Well, it's an acronym for the Federal Service of Control of Narcotics. Mm. It was headed by a St. Petersburg ally of Putin named Viktor Cherkasov until 2006. Then Mr. Cherkasov began to get embroiled in some conflict with other security agencies and security chiefs. And so he left, and a man named Viktor Ivanov was named to head the Federal Anti-Narcotic Service. It became very powerful, and its purview was extended pretty much beyond narcotics. And it finally was disbanded in 2016.
And what was interesting is the former deputy head now has a Spanish arrest warrant out for him.
Yes.
And am I right? It was related to drugs. Is that right?
Yes. It was related to drugs. Yes, and I should add that, I mean, drug contraband and drug trafficking has been and continues to be a huge enterprise for the Russian mafia. And the oligarchs are connected to this mafia. So this anti-drug agency was particularly important.
Yeah. And was it in a sense turning a blind eye?
Yes. It was very selective in who it went after for criminal activities.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's move on to the SVR, which is probably one of the better known agencies. And this is Russia's sort of foreign intelligence services. Would I say it's sort of similar to MI6 and the CIA?
Yes, the SVR is Russia's foreign intelligence service. It was formed from the first chief directorate of the KGB, the Foreign Intelligence Directorate. And it's a separate agency now. It used to be part of the KGB. Its headquarters are outside of Moscow at Yasineva, and the head of the SVR is a man named Sergei Naryshkin, a Putin loyalist. The Foreign Intelligence Service could be compared to to Britain's MI6 or the U.S. CIA. Its functions are intelligence gathering, but particularly what we used to call in KGB days active measures. And the SVR continues to carry out active measures today. The purpose of these things, these measures, which are basically disinformation or disinformatia, propaganda campaigns, and things such as interfering in elections and trying to influence the elections in democratic countries, just to give you an example. But the overall purpose is to undermine Western democracies. And so the Foreign Intelligence Service is a very powerful organization, but it's kind of still shrouded in a certain amount of secrecy, and it's often difficult to actually get to the bottom of their disinformation and active measures campaigns because other agencies, such as the Soviet military intelligence, the GRU, do similar things.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's have a look at the GRU, because this is Russian military intelligence, isn't it?
Yes, this is the main intelligence directorate, the GRU. Actually, just not long ago, apparently the name was changed from the main intelligence directorate to just the intelligence directorate. It's not clear why, because it doesn't appear that the GRU's functions have actually been curtailed in any way. Mm. But so this is Russia's military intelligence agency. It is under the general staff of the Soviet Army. And the Russia's military intelligence, or the GRU, performs traditional espionage, as well as more technical espionage. It has spy satellites, but its traditional function, and it goes back many years to the Stalin era, has been to gather intelligence on military-related activities in the West. Its current chief is a man named Sergei Korobov. He has been the head of the GRU since 2016, and the GRU is believed to have been involved in some of the assassinations that have occurred, political assassinations abroad, including the recent attempt on the life of Sergei Skripal in the UK this year. But I think that Mr. Skripal, as we know, was a former officer, a former colonel in the GRU. But I would say that there are still questions about whether the GRU actually was the agency that carried out the poisonings. I think it could have possibly been the FSB as well. I mention this because in 2006, the FSB had its functions expanded, its mandate expanded to include actually carrying out assassinations of traitors and political opponents abroad. So this could have been an operation of the FSB or the GRU, because the GRU also carries out political assassinations.
Yeah, yeah. And so am I right with the political assassinations? It seems to be the FSB might be the agency responsible for the sort of domestic killings, whilst the SVR/GRU could be involved with the killings internationally.
Yes, but as I mentioned, the FSB was given functions to do that. It was given the mandate to do counterterrorism and counter-extremism, which is broadly interpreted in Russian as basically the fight against political enemies abroad. So the FSB was, for example, the agency that carried out the assassination of Alexander Litvinenko in London. So it's difficult to know which agency actually was responsible for some of these crimes.
Yeah. Yeah, which in a way, I suppose, is sort of part of the point, isn't it? They want to make it difficult to exactly pin it back to Russia, don't they?
Well, I would only say one thing, which is that the Kremlin and Mr. Putin ultimately has control over all these agencies. Mm. So whether it's the SVR, the GRU, or the FSB, maybe not as important as the fact that if it's one of these agencies, the orders would have been given by the Kremlin.
So since Vladimir Putin has been president of Russia, there's been a large number of his critics and political opponents have come to a bad end. Can you talk to us a little bit about this?
Yes, several of the critics of the Kremlin have come to a bad end since Mr. Putin came to power. And in fact, even before he became president in 2000, in 1998, when he was head of the FSB, the Federal Security Service, a prominent parliamentarian named Galina Starovoitova from St. Petersburg, a Russian Duma member, was gunned down in her apartment building, and the Russian authorities have never found who did it. I don't know that I would blame Putin directly, but the fact that he was head of the FSB and was responsible for finding out who did it is pretty important. It kind of set the stage for these further political assassinations. And I should also say that Starovoitova was very outspoken in her campaign to call former KGB officials and Communist Party officials to account for what they did in the Soviet period. She was advocating a policy of so-called lustration, where the new regime looks back and has these various crimes that were committed by the security and police in earlier periods. They call to account these officials and bar them from government service. So Starovoitova represented quite a threat to Russia's security agencies. Just to mention some other murders, Paul Klebnikov, who was an American, he was the editor of Forbes Russia, and he was gunned down he was investigating corruption in Russia at high levels. He was gunned down just coming out of his office in Moscow in July 2004. His murder has never been solved. His wife and his brother, who I interviewed, have gone to Russia repeatedly trying to get the support of the Putin regime to get to the bottom of who murdered him. But thus far, beyond blaming Chechen hitmen for the murder, no one has found out who actually ordered the murder. Really, one of the most prominent political opponents and critics of Putin who has been murdered was Anna Politkovskaya, who is a journalist for the paper Novaya Gazeta. She was gunned down in the stairwell of her apartment building in October 2006. And Chechens, as often is the case, were blamed for carrying out her murder. There were several trials, but no one has identified who ordered the killing, despite constant efforts by her family. And Politkovskaya was a particularly virulent critic of Vladimir Putin himself, so he would have had strong motive to have ordered her murder.
Yes.
Then, of course, there is the example of Alexander Litvinenko, who was poisoned by polonium in November of 2006, just a month after Politkovskaya was murdered. Mm. He and Politkovskaya were friends. He had warned Anna that she needed to be careful and should probably leave Russia.
Yeah.
Now, we know, I think the Litvinenko case is probably one of the most important cases, because for the first time we've had a proper investigation into the murder. The reason in Russia that we haven't found or that there haven't been proper investigations and identifying the people who were the masterminds, and this would include actually the murder of Boris Nemtsov in February 2015, Putin controls all the investigative organs. He controls the MVD, the FSB, and the investigative committee, all of which are authorized to carry out investigations of these political murders. But the men who run these investigations are Putin's friends and supporters, so they never get to the bottom of who the mastermind was. So with the Litvinenko murder, it's particularly significant that the British actually, after long efforts by Litvinenko's wife, Marina, finally held a public inquiry. And in January 2016, Sir Robert Owen, who conducted the inquiry, came out with a report in which he, after exhaustive testimony and a tremendous amount of research, Sir Robert Owen was able to say that two FSB-hired hitmen, Andrei Lugovoy and Dmitry Kovtun, actually were the men who poisoned Litvinenko with polonium-210. So this is this is the first time we've actually been able to point the finger at Russia.
Yeah, and there was so much evidence linking them from both CCTV to the radiation trail. It was it was so obvious that they were connected. There's a counter information sort of campaign going on about the Skripal case right now, and a lot of people are sort of like, how could Russia be so obvious? But I mean, they were so obvious with the murder of Litvinenko.
Well, yes, and you know, it's very interesting. In the Litvinenko case, these two killers were very sloppy because they left a trail of polonium all over London and in the airplanes and in their hotels. And apparently, they weren't told, they weren't given proper training in how to use this poison. And it's interesting that in the case of Skripal, the poisoning of Skripal and his daughter, Yulia, we have now seen a similar phenomenon. The two men that are the prime suspects in carrying out this poisoning, actually, which was done with Novichok, a nerve agent, these two men were not cautious enough, and they actually managed to contaminate their hotel room.
Yeah.
And then they left this bottle of this perfume bottle, discarded it, which has enabled the British authorities to establish a trail. It's very interesting that what points to the Kremlin in both the Litvinenko and the Litvinenko murder and in the poisoning of the Skripals is that in both cases, these poisonings are only manufactured in secret laboratories that would be under the direct control of the Russian government. So this really implicates the Russian government in both of these cases.
Yeah, and historically we've seen so many cases where poison's been used by the Russian government to silence its critics. It's,
Yes, exactly. There have been several murders, suspicious murders, of Russian oligarchs and critics, defectors, and attempted murders in the UK. So most people think that this kind of thing doesn't happen in the U.S. To a certain extent, this is true, but I should point out that there was a very mysterious death in November of 2015 in a Washington, D.C. hotel room that has led journalists and other experts to wonder whether the Kremlin wasn't involved. And this is a man called Mikhail Lesin. He was at one point had been the head of Gazprom Media. Mm. He was a very powerful oligarch, very wealthy. His children live in California, I believe, and he had assets in California. So he died suddenly in his hotel room. And initially, and actually the story is still the same, American authorities, the FBI, investigated, and they said that Lesin, who was a known heavy drinker or alcoholic, if you will say, had died from falls that he had incurred stumbling while he was drunk. But there were rumors quite early on that, in fact, he might have been murdered. And part of the story that was reported about the murder was that Lesin had been cooperating with the FBI and giving them information about Russian oligarchs and the Russian mafia and corrupt financial activities on the part of the mafia and oligarchs. And so this might have been a motive to do away with Lesin by the Kremlin, but American authorities denied this, and they said the murder was it was not a murder, that Lessen had died from these self-inflicted falls. He had died from falling. But now we know from recent reporting by the New York Times that, in fact, the FBI, as far back as 2015, was making attempts to get information from Russian oligarchs who visited the United States. One example would be Oleg Deripaska, who they tried to recruit but were unsuccessful. So this, again, raises questions about whether the FBI was trying to recruit Mihai Lessen and whether or not he was cooperating with the FBI, which would, again, raise questions about his death in November of 2015 in Washington.
Yeah. Well, look, Amy, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. It's been a real pleasure to chat with you and a real honor to have you on. Can you just tell us where listeners can find out more about you and your work?
I write for The Daily Beast, which is an online publication in the United States. I write about Russia. I'm working on a new book, and I also have a website called amyknight.org, which can be accessed, and people can contact me through my website if they have further questions.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for joining me on the show today.
You're very welcome, Chris. I enjoyed it.
Like what we're doing? Support the show by becoming a Dry Cleaner Cast Patreon subscriber today. Go to patreon.com/drycleanercast. For more information about the podcast, visit our website at drycleanercast.co.uk. Thanks for listening.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisisCLE.com/podcast.